Hello, I'm Nick Spencer, and you're listening to the seventh series of Reading Our Times, the podcast that introduces you to the books and the ideas that are shaping the world today. Listen with us, and we'll explore the new elite, the meaning of God, the coming economic crash, the transformation of the earth, the mind of humans and aliens, food in hard times, what it means to be a philosopher, the end of the world. And in a special live recording in London in November, we'll be looking at the coming age of the machine. Whenever we at Theos commission public opinion polling, we usually slip in a question about belief in God. Everyone knows that the non-religion category in the UK has overtaken the religion one, but, strange as it may seem, there's not an overwhelming correlation between religion and belief in God. Particularly at our current cultural moment, there are plenty of people who choose to distance themselves from the label of religion, but have a persistent, sometimes even a very strong, belief in God. For example, last time we asked the questions in 2021, we found that 53% of adults did not regard themselves as belonging to any particular religion, whereas only 30% said, "I don't believe in God." Quantitative surveys of this nature can only take you so far, however, and they don't allow you to explore what someone actually means when they say they don't believe in God, or indeed, when they say they do. God is one of those words that we use all the time without interrogating what we actually mean by the term, assuming that we all mean the same thing when we use it, even if we don't. So what do we mean when we say the word God? What does belief or disbelief in God actually entail? And God being God, or not as the case may be, can we even put any of this into words? The Experience of God by David Bentley Hart is one of the very best books published on this topic over recent years. David is a prominent, prolific, and provocative scholar of religion and philosophy, and his works cover a huge ground with great learning in eminently readable prose. And David joins us this week to talk about how the word God functions. In effect, what do we mean when we talk about God? David, welcome to Reading Our Times.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well. I'm particularly pleased to have this conversation. You say early on in the book, one of the more insidious aspects of today's public debates over belief and unbelief is that they're often sustained by the illusion that both sides are using the same words in the same way. But they're not, are they? Give me some examples of what you mean by that fundamental misunderstanding around the word God.
Well, as often as not, the more strident voices on the atheist side assume a picture of God that maybe many believers have, but even then inflected in a subtly different way. Principally, they think of God as some large but still finite psychological personality who is a supreme being among other beings and to whom one relates across a distance of communication the way you would with another human being. And at the philosophical level, this is an extraordinarily crude notion, obviously, since none of the great theistic traditions, East or West, conceives of God as a personality in that sense, a psychological subject, or certainly an object among other objects. But even religious believers who are not necessarily philosophically sophisticated in the sort of conceptual vocabulary they possess generally understand that this is not what they mean by God, that the mystery that they're addressing in their prayers, for instance, in their liturgies, can't be reduced to some object among other objects, some person among other persons.
So is your impression that this is a straw God, or do you think they derive it from popular notions?
Well, I think their concept of God probably never got past the Sunday school level. There's a point early in life when, of course, that's how we think of God. We think we're just talking about the executive officer of the universe. And most of them took leave of any real experience of religious language and religious life and certainly didn't investigate the philosophical dimensions of any particular traditions pretty early in life. So I suspect part of it is simply premature detachment from the conversation. But yeah, of course, they're popular images. I mean, it's not a mystery or a secret that the more polemical side of the atheist debate tends to engage with fundamentalists. It's very rare that they make any serious attempt to deal with persons better able to meet their critiques, because they themselves are fundamentalists simply in a negative mode.
So it's almost, if it's a reinforcing relationship that's going on there, one group of fundamentalists on one side reacts to the other group on the other side, and they see in the other party the reason for their own existence.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very much a local debate between two parties who share a fairly crude notion of God, neither of whom is deeply grounded in, to my mind, the great traditions of classical theistic thought.
So how do you respond then to the objection that, well, if you have a straightforward reading, say, of the Old Testament, you find quite an anthropomorphic, interventionist, activist kind of God? I mean, there's no accident that Dawkins, for example, loves to focus on the Old Testament as proof of his particular conception of God, the God who zaps things and kills people and intervenes and so on in certain ways. How do you respond to that?
Well, that is mythological material that was gradually absorbed into the two traditions of Judaism and Christianity, and then later in a different way in Islam. Only in the modern period were there any really significant numbers of persons who took this to be strictly literal in the sense we would use the word today. But certainly, yeah, that's about as interesting as saying that Greek mythology is full of anthropomorphic deities, and therefore somehow that tells against later philosophical pagan monotheism. Obviously, it doesn't. But again, it makes the point for me that what we're talking about here is a fundamentalist reading of texts shared in common between two parties who have contrary reactions to that reading. But remember, in the ancient church, the medieval church, even the term literal, ad literam, didn't mean what we mean by it. It didn't mean that these texts were documentaries of events that had happened precisely as they're narrated. Instead, it just meant one had to pay attention to what was on the page before one attempted a spiritual interpretation. But the prevailing schools of thought of the ancient church and of ancient rabbinic tradition and of philosophical Judaism in the Hellenistic period and throughout the medieval period of both faiths is that you can't read these things strictly literally, and that instead one applies them spiritually. And that doesn't mean, incidentally, that one's decoding some secret spiritual message hidden in the text. No one's made that claim. But rather that the act of reading itself is an inspired act, and that one takes these stories, these myths, these sometimes horrifying myths, and uses them within the context of a larger spiritual apprehension of God, one that developed over many, many centuries, but that clearly has never been bound until the early 20th century, in fact. Not even earlier than that, to a strict literalism.
That strict literalism is a response, isn't it, to the growing movement of biblical historical criticism in the 19th century, with certain believers wanting to assert the definitive truth of the text in the face of a movement that they see, or they think, is undermining it, right?
Yes, but also there's another side to that, because what has already happened by that period, by the time of the so-called fundamentals, a series of documents that reformed theologians in Princeton produced in the early 20th century, is that the very notion of what constitutes verifiable truth had already been somewhat altered. I mean, we'd already begun to think, and in part because of the revolution in the sciences, of course, that truth, all we can mean by truth, is a correspondence between certain propositional positions and certain objective facts that can be verified experientially or by experiment, or as facts inscribed in historical documents of impeccable credibility, you know. Whereas for someone like Augustine, the truth of the text is a kind of spiritual commerce between God and the soul, using the text as the occasion, a language of communication, of symbols, of moral instruction, of allegory, at times of, you know, true stories, but certainly not a collection of propositions to be demonstrated. So you're right, on the one hand, it was a reaction to the historical critical method, but it was a reaction already shaped by a certain epistemological and scientific movements of the early modern and modern period.
So I wonder whether underlying all this is a crisis in the use of language, whereby once upon a time we understood that language was polyvalent and could be understood in a polyphonous way, whereas in the wake of the scientific revolution, we've increasingly been inclined to say that the only truth in words, the only truth in a text, is what is literally in front of you, and everything else is just incidental or invention. And if we've narrowed down our capacity to read in that way, no wonder we find ourselves with a paucity of vision at the end of it. Is that fair?
Oh, of course. And these are literary texts. They are meant to be engaged with at any number of levels. No doubt you know that what came to be the standard understanding of spiritual reading by about the 4th century, there was a literal level. Again, not a level of documentary facts, but a level simply of what's on the page. So that if you're going to read it spiritually, and the text has a lily there, don't read it in terms of a rose. But it doesn't mean that either the rose or the lily ever blossomed in anyone's real garden. Then, of course, there's a moral level. There's the allegorical level, which, again, is not a matter of decoding some hidden text concealed behind the stories, but rather spiritual reading under the guidance of inspiration. And there's an anagogical level, which has to do with last things, you know, both personal and cosmic. But that's just one scheme. In point of fact, it was understood until, again, very recently, relatively speaking, that these texts should be read in a literary, a spiritual, a contemplative mode. The term preferred, for instance, in the Greek East for the reading of scripture was theoria, which is not theory in our modern sense, but really does mean contemplation, a kind of contemplative state that allows a sort of poetic inspiration and religious inspiration on the part of the reader to enter into the text by any variety of doorways.
I'm glad you mentioned the literary reading of these texts, because you have a very helpful illustration towards the end of the book about Tolstoy and Anna Karenina. Unpack that for us.
I think what I said was looking for God in the way that Dawkins or Dennett or someone like that assumes we do is like looking for Tolstoy among the characters of Anna Karenina, and on failing to find him, declaring that it's preposterous to suggest that there's someone involved in the reality of this text called Tolstoy. Yeah. And if I then say, well, he's present in every single syllable, every single grapheme of the text, and yet at the same time is not an object within that text, you can simply dismiss me as speaking esoteric nonsense, perhaps. In Greek especially, but not only in Greek, distinctions tend to be made in different kinds of knowledge. And in Greek, it's in particular, we distinguish between episteme, which is a kind of factual propositional comportment towards a statement of putative fact. But there's also gnosis, or gnosis, as it's often mispronounced, which is an immediate knowledge that actually isn't mediated by concepts, a propositional concept, because it's a direct encounter with something that can't be reduced merely to propositional comportments, right? And it's the latter that the spiritual reading of the text seeks, because God can't be known as a simple object of factual reduction. In all of these traditions, the true knowledge of God is an embrace of intimacy that exceeds what could be said.
Yes. There are lots of bad ways, false ways, misleading ways that we can speak about God. Let's try and home in on a more accurate, or at least more fruitful, way we can. And I want to begin by talking about creation, about which you have a great deal to say in the book. You say at one point that God's act of creation is understood as the whole event of nature and existence, not as a distinct causal agency that in some way rivals the natural process of creation. Now, I suspect most people listening will have the idea of creation as simply the beginning of something. Can you distinguish different ways in which we talk about creation?
It's a curious thing that this seems, for many, a sort of difficult thing. By persons even who have degrees in philosophy, this is a distinction that has been made from the very beginning of, say, Christianity, but of other faiths as well, that creation is not a mechanical event in a history of mechanical events. It's not simply the first. In fact, great Christian 4th century saint Basil of Caesarea mocks this way of thinking. It turns it into an infinite regress of God in time. What's the first moment? What's the first moment of the first moment? What's the first moment of the first moment of the first? If you think this way, you're thinking in childish terms. Rather, creation is simply the importation of being to all that is in every moment for us as experienced as time, but just the eternal gift of being to all that is from the infinite plenitude of being that God is. And therefore, far from being some sort of rival to some other account of the arising of the world, it has always been posited simply as the ontological condition, the condition of the possibility of the being of anything happening, not as an event among events. This, again, as I say, should not be hard to grasp, because surely Daniel Dennett's my bete noir, American, and he's the most annoyingly persistent in misunderstanding the things he thinks he's tearing to pieces. So presumably he knows, for instance, that Jews and Christians, Muslims, Hindus, Sikhs, all understand that when a baby is conceived, that there really is spermatozoon and an ovum, and that there's a full natural process there. And yet at the same time, in all these faiths, it's believed that God is the creator of that person. So obviously, you know, it's not an either or. Did God create the baby, or was the baby produced by natural processes? Why they can't extend that in their understanding to the full picture of existence, or why they say it's somehow an evasion or an obfuscation to speak in that way, I cannot for the life of me imagine, because it seems to me not that difficult a conceptual distinction to make and understand and sustain.
Yeah. And this is the source of the point you make in the book about even a universe that was physically infinite in both size and duration, and ours, for all we know, is not, but even if it were physically infinite, would still be metaphysically finite. In other words, it wouldn't be the ground of its own existence, right?
Right. I mean, and even Thomas Aquinas says that. I mean, he says it would not matter if the universe had no beginning and no end. It would not matter if it had no boundaries in space or time. It would still be a contingent reality, because it's composed of composite things and events, none of which is sufficient for itself, and all taken together still constitutes a composite event that's not capable of accounting for its own existence. It's composed of things that always already by definition exist.
So let me begin to play a little bit of devil's advocate here. I'm going to pick up the difference. Major categories in the book being consciousness and bliss, and we've been talking a bit about being. It cannot possibly be the case, you say at one point, that there are only contingent realities, which is effectively what we've been talking about. Why not? Why can't the universe be a brute fact in the way that Bertrand Russell thought it was?
Well, for the simple reason that if it's composed entirely of contingencies, then the notion of an absolute contingency is a contradiction. If you try to reduce a contingent reality to premises that are purely contingent, you still end up with contingencies that don't explain the difference between existing and not existing. And simply saying that everything might always have existed falls afoul of the mistake, again, that even Thomas Aquinas points to, of thinking that contingency simply refers to whether something had a prior or antecedent cause. It's whether in itself it can possibly be its own ground or not. And if it cannot, and certainly, again, by definition, the contingent cannot, then one ultimately has to surrender to the rationally obvious alternative that there must be something absolute upon which the contingent rests, which is not composite, which is not a sequence of becoming, which is not finite.
Mm. So how do you respond to criticism then that what you've effectively done there is simply say that God is something that cannot, by definition, not exist? Because we exist in a contingent universe.
Yeah.
That contingent universe can't be the ground of its own being. Mm. QED, there has to be a God by definition.
Well, yeah, there has to be an absolute ground. But the moment you say that, certain things come to the fore. You have to realize that why you're making that conclusion involves the negation of the things that mark something out as contingent. So you begin at the philosophical level to have a definition of what you're talking about, and it includes such things as infinity, eternity, simplicity, immateriality, and all the classical attributes that you would expect. But that's not the end of the argument. That's only one argument among many. And, of course, somehow you also come to the conclusion that this absolute reality is the source and the foundation of a contingent reality, which bears many extraordinary marks of order, rational consistency, hospitality to conscious thought and intentionality. And one begins to form a kind of metaphysical picture of God. This has been the history of thought, again, both in the East and the West. It's not the end of one's definition, but it is the beginning of the realization that the mystery of being demands a kind of answer that can't be located among beings, among finite beings. What follows thereafter, then you have to turn to other considerations, like, say, consciousness or the contents of intentionality in regard to transcendent, seemingly transcendental ends of the will and the mind and all that. And then, of course, most traditions believe that there's been a history of revelation, that somehow the source of all things, God, discloses itself, himself, or however you want to put it, in various ways, by various means, again, logical, poetical, spiritual, moral.
I'm glad you mentioned consciousness there, because I said that the second part of the book. You and I have talked about this in a different context in a working group on science and religion that we're both part of. And I put in that discussion the idea that maybe consciousness is just an emergent phenomenon. Lots of things do emerge from simpler structures in our contingent reality. Why isn't consciousness something that emerges from material that isn't fundamentally conscious itself?
Yeah, the term emergence has become a wonderfully useful way of obscuring a great number of necessary logical distinctions. In one sense, the term is used merely to describe structural amplification of things, you know, that the properties of various ingredient parts of larger structures in combination with one another produce effects that none of the ingredients in and of itself could have produced, the way that in water, two hydrogen atoms, one oxygen atom, produce a molecule that has fluidity. That's not emergence in the strong sense. That's simply structural complexity that can be reduced again to its ingredient parts without remainder. But that's not what we're talking about in the case of consciousness, is it, or of mind? There we're talking about something that philosophers call strong emergence, which is a myth. It was something that cannot possibly be true, that certain combinations of material ingredients can yield results that are irreducible, again, to those ingredients. That's a meaningless statement. That's like simply saying something happened, magic occurred, and something arose that in itself is intrinsically discontinuous with its ingredient parts. That, if it were true, would already be a violation of physicalism or naturalism or materialism. So you would think that would not be an attractive notion to a committed atheist, though I've known some who invoke it as if better to invoke a sort of arbitrary magic in nature than to suggest that there's a rational coherence that exceeds the merely physically reductive. The more you phenomenologically unpack what consciousness is, it's not a property, it's a kind of activity which rests upon itself in a self-reflective way that cannot be reduced to physical causes, precisely because it is contrary to the logic of physical causation. The purely physicalist or so-called mechanical picture of nature excludes final causes, and yet the mind is nothing but a series of final causes consciously working themselves out. The consecutive logic, reasoning, every time you say reason out of syllogism, you're making connections of a logical kind leading to a conclusion, which is qualitatively totally unlike one electrochemical event prompting another simply through an antecedent force working on a consequent object, but principally because the first person experience of consciousness is so qualitatively discontinuous from third-person electrochemical events that there is literally no causal narrative that can be constructed between the two that's anything other than an empty assertion. Well, if that's the case, there's a problem, because if it were really physically reducible, then there'd be an analytic, an immediately obvious, logically continuous convertibility between deducing what mind is from physical elements and reducing mind again to physical elements, and we're capable of doing neither. Moreover, there are any number of very good arguments made even by materialists or persons who aren't religious, say like the philosopher of mind David Chalmers, for why it's impossible to reduce consciousness to physical causes.
And does that steer you towards what has historically been known as an idealist philosophical position?
Well, yeah, or just about every position other than strict materialism. That is, with the exception of, interestingly, anomalous figures like Democritus, and then even not him when you actually look at the implications of what he believed, it was generally assumed up until the early modern period that the foundation of reality was more like mind than like matter as we think of it now. In fact, matter as we think of it now, as a sort of mechanical order of the exchange of forces without intrinsic teleology, without intrinsic purpose, is very much a modern concept with just a few ancient precursors or foreshadowings.
Let's move on to bliss.
Bliss.
Which is a surprising and provocative word. I don't think we've talked about bliss in Reading Our Times yet after six or seven series, so this is a real opportunity. I want to quote something you say in the book. It's a slightly long quote, but again, a very helpful one, I found. One desires money, not in itself, but only for what it can purchase. And one desires the things money can purchase, not simply as ends in themselves, but because they correspond to more general and abstract longings for comfort, prestige, power, diversion, or what have you. And one desires all such things out of a still deeper and more general desire for happiness itself, whatever that may be, and for a fuller share in the goodness of being. In this world, the desirable is always desirable in respect of some yet more elementary and comprehensive need or yearning. I suspect that's the thing that would most resonate with religious believers in the sense of what they find ultimately in God is the satisfaction of their deepest inchoate yearnings and desires. Would you agree?
Yeah. I want to point out, though, that we don't have to confine this to the world of religious experience, right? It's not simply the case that the mind is capable of purposive intentionality, of being guided to ends. It's that the entire structure of mental activity depends upon this prior orientation to realities that aren't found within the natural world, but without which we have no experience of the natural world. The traditional way of speaking of these ends is as transcendentals, precisely because they're not finite objects within the world, but they are the structure of our judgment, our evaluation, our desire, our thinking about the world, the good, the true, the beautiful. And we move towards finite things, even when we don't know we're doing it, in respect of and in the light of this always more primordial desire to know what is true, to possess what is good. I mean, possess not necessarily in a material sense, but that too. And to me, beauty is an especially interesting case, because you can reduce most desires if you try to, if you're cunning enough, you can make it sound like all of them have a utilitarian end. And there are attempts to make the beauty instinct seem like it fits within a utilitarian calculus. I mean, there's a very wonderful but misguided man named Dennis Dutton who wrote a book about art, trying to reduce it all to sexual selection and evolutionary memories of landscapes that were appealing to our ancestors. But of course, it required him leaving out almost the entirety of actual aesthetic experience, because I think, as we know, the actual desire for beauty immeasurably and again and again and again far exceeds and transcends and actually comes into conflict with mere pragmatic considerations. There's this absolute hunger for something that cannot be reduced to, you know, good food, sex, shelter, triumph over your enemies. And yet this is indicative of the whole structure of how the rational mind has a world and how the world accommodates the presence of a rational mind within it. And I would say that when you really think about people who try to reduce morality, like evolutionary psychologists try to reduce morality to the spandrels within a capacity for kin selection, again and again, the contradictions just mount up and mount up and mount up and just become more and more preposterous. The reason I use the term bliss, incidentally, he's using the Sanskrit tersit, sat-chit-ananda, as a definition for God, being, consciousness, bliss. And by bliss, I mean that longing for the fulfillment of primordial desires so deep that they are the very ground of our understanding and our experience of the world and of our existence as persons.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that Sanskrit dimension, because one of the things that really struck me about the book was the breadth of religious traditions on which you draw. Now, as I understand it, you write yourself from within an Eastern Orthodox Christian tradition, but you're very clear throughout the book that what you're saying doesn't narrowly apply to that tradition or to the Christian or even to the Abrahamic traditions, but draws on and can be found in strands of Hinduism and Buddhism and even Taoism. Is it possible, some people will say, to talk about God across religious traditions in that way? Are they really that commensurable?
Sure. I mean, I'm sorry, but when all your traditions tell you, well, there is a source of all reality which is infinite, simple, eternal, that transcends our ability to describe it, but that is nearer to us than our inmost selves and higher than our utmost selves, that is at once transcendent and immanent, which is the source of being and life. Well, you know, after a while, you realize there's only one gent or lady or whatever who corresponds to that description, that they're all talking about the same thing. Now, they may have different symbols, different doctrinal systems. Some of them may be truer on one aspect of this reality and less true on another than other traditions, but what isn't questionable and what doesn't even seem to me to be open to question is that they're talking about the same ultimate reality. Now, within every tradition, you will have fundamentalists who say, oh, the God of the philosophers is not. Well, if the God of the philosophers is not the God of your religion, then your religion is false, because what is not logically entailed is not worthy of either adherence or affirmation. You can simply ignore it. Obviously, what we can reason out about the ground or the conditions of reality is itself part of revelation, so to speak. The way reality reveals itself in our thoughts and words and intellectual and moral aspirations.
So here's a provocative question for you. Do you think that the different revelations of God claimed in different religious traditions are all of equal value?
Yes. Some are of higher value than others in certain aspects, and others are of lesser value, or the same one that may be of greater value regarding, say, the nature of divine simplicity, say, may be defective in regard to another in understanding the nature of divine love. But if you mean, do I think that all contain truths worth knowing about that reality, and often truths that other traditions express more poorly, I would say yes. They should all be consulted. They should all be known. They should all be revered. They should also all be subject to criticism, because there's a difference between the truth towards which one is pointing and the way in which one points. You know, look at the moon, you fool, not at the finger.
So let me conclude with a question that refers back to one of the comments I made in the introduction about the way in which this conversation is often conducted by people who are talking past one another.
Yeah.
And how, as you have said, there is a desire, a hunger, thirst, a need for God that is evident beyond religious traditions. This isn't a characteristic only of religious people. What would you say to people who effectively they have almost lost a vocabulary, have certainly imbibed the technician or godling attitude, understanding of God that's popular amongst the new atheist crowd, and therefore dismiss not only the great religious traditions, but to some extent, their own inchoate yearnings? Effectively, how would you help somebody navigate to a richer, fuller, truer, more satisfying understanding of what we talk about when we talk about God?
Oh, that's a hard question. It's a hard
Sorry.
Well, it's a hard question because you're talking about the prevailing tendencies of an entire epoch of the world. We're at a moment when we have altered communally through a long history of, in a sense, unconscious decisions about how we see reality. We've altered our experience of reality as such. I think we both know Ian McGilchrist, you know, he'd say we're shifting towards a left hemispheric vision of reality, or disproportionately or preponderantly so, you know. Well, that's one way of thinking about it. We've come to see the world as an economy of mechanistic forces in brute collision with one another, yielding an irrational and pointless universe. And it's very hard to fight against the prevailing picture of reality. But there are things, I think, within all human experience that can be consulted, to which one can be awakened again. And one of them, again, is just, you know, this the mystery of these primordial desires for the good and the beautiful and the true.
Mm.
And I think if we can retreat at times to something I think we all knew as children, which is the experience of sudden wonder, not at anything in particular, but at everything as such, it is an experience we do have again and again in later life, I think ever more fleetingly perhaps, the more our indurated habits of thought tend to turn us into functions within the machine we inhabit. But when we suddenly realize that the mystery of things isn't what they are so much as that they are, and that something that can't be reduced to some simple narrative of physical causes is the deeper mystery of reality. If you can reawaken that, I tend to think that in our day, the privileged means for doing that is more through the arts than through religion. Mm. But even there, there's been a decline. I mean, our culture has become so much sort of almost militantly mechanistic, not just the view of reality we presume, but the way it functions, the way we relate to it, the way we relate to one another. The arts, like communal traditions, like religions, also are in a sort of state of steady decline. That is the ability of most persons to attend to them. And more the arts, as we understand them, tend to become just vehicles of self-expression rather than windows onto a mystery that's summoning us to itself. So I don't know. I tend to think, though, that if one can just at times get people to pause and reflect on that mystery that they knew, even as children, to be something that exceeded simple calculation, that's the way to sort of try to unwind the tightly spun web. But I don't know.
The book is called The Experience of God, Being, Consciousness, Bliss. David Bentley Hart, thank you very much indeed for speaking to Reading Our Times.
Thank you.
Next week, I'll be speaking to Philip Ball about his book, The Book of Minds, Understanding Ourselves and Other Beings, From Animals to Aliens.
What on earth could be the evolutionary advantage of having a mind that could come up with the theory of general relativity? Or could come up with Bleak House or Pride and Prejudice? What is that for?
You've been listening to Reading Our Times from the think tank Theos. It's produced by Phil Bodger. Our team includes Daniel Turner, Fiona Hanscom, and Chinny McDonald. Special thanks to Nina Humphreys, who composed our theme tune and all the music. You can subscribe to Reading Our Times on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and you can also find us on our website, theosthinktank.co.uk, where you can find details of a special live event in London this November, in which we'll be talking about the coming age of the machine with Lord Robert Skidelsky. We hope to see you there.